from A Letter to America About the Buffalo Bills and Bills Mafia, as written by Aaron McDuffie and sent to Bruce Nolan as part of his podcast, The Bruce Exclusive, on BuffaloRumblings.com. Sometimes things change quick. We find ourselves from the top down towards the bottom. The Buffalo Bills of the last 30 years have been a perfect reflection of that dynamic. They used to be really great, and everybody talked about the big ballers and shot callers that were Buffalo. And then they lost it all, and no one has heard barely anything for the last 30 years until now. Now things have been turning around the last couple years for this city and this team. A lot of things fell apart, and don't get me wrong, that hurt. But every day we've picked ourselves up and tried to make what we can of tomorrow. This team that has, like clockwork, found ways to fail one way or another over the past 30 years, has instead found ways to win despite all the reasons why it shouldn't. The red, white, and blue isn't coincidence. The Buffalo Bills are America's team. Not just for the colors, not just for winning, but because I think we can all relate to the bottom just falling out, everything falling apart, loss after loss after loss, stacked up higher and higher. But you win by shaking off yesterday and seizing today as best you can. And when you get beaten down yet again, you keep getting back up. Because in truth, life isn't about winning. It's about facing its challenges and not quitting. You lose by quitting. This team has faced odds and challenges it shouldn't have succeeded against, and it hasn't quit because things were too big or too much to overcome. It rised, it grinded. In the past year, despite all the doubt, despite all the reasons why not, it found ways to stack W after W after W. I'll be honest, in 2020 and 2021 so far, we could all use a reminder that tomorrow always comes. Tomorrow's a new day, and not quitting and just keep trying will get you so far in life, even if you don't see the changes overnight. So, while we're known for circling the wagons, dragging all doubters and haters and anyone who has ever slighted us, even in the smallest of ways, here's a seat on the bandwagon. You've earned a spot to feel joy and be reminded that hope pays off. As I've said before, we win by looking out for each other. So no matter who you are or what franchise you come from, welcome. It is my hope that you feel in your bones the phrase, "No one circles the wagons like the Buffalo Bills." You are listening to On Further Review. I'm Cameron.
And I'm Micah. On Further Review is a conversation about the details of the most remarkable sporting events.
Join our discussion of upsets, dynasties, and how one event can be the difference between being a footnote and being a legend. This is On Further Review. Welcome to On Further Review, a podcast where we like to look back at some of the interesting and remarkable things that have happened in the sports history pages. And today we want to take a look at the Buffalo Bills, a team that now here in 2020 is on the cusp of getting to the big game, to the Super Bowl, kind of a resurgence of their team, resurgence and excitement for Bills Mafia. And we want to look back and kind of see some of the teams that they put together, some of the things that their organization has done, accomplished, maybe left on the table here in the past, as we look back at the Buffalo Bills. Specifically here, looking at the at kind of the early 1990s.
When we think of the word dynasty, the team that almost never comes to mind but needs to come to mind is the Buffalo Bills. So, like, let's go back to the 1990 season, right?
Yeah.
Back in 1990, actually, you can go back to 1989. The Buffalo Bills are a struggling franchise, about 8-8. 9-7, 7-9, not that remarkable in the lowly AFC East, dominated by teams like the Miami Dolphins of Dan Marino and those guys like that, or even Drew Bledsoe of the New England Patriots of those late 80s, early 90s years. So this team from 9-7, nobody's really making mindful of them. Nobody's doing anything about them. Somehow in the year 1990 reaches the Super Bowl. And this was just a remarkable feat on their end to kind of claw their way into it. They had some phenomenal players on this team, guys who will enshrined in the Hall of Fame forever.
For sure.
Guys like James Lofton, obviously Jim Kelly. You have
Thurman Thomas.
Thurman
Bruce
Thomas
Smith on defense, kind of loaded.
Yep. As a Packers fan, we always loved Don Beebe for his moments at Lambeau as well too. So Don Beebe was on that team back in those days in the early 90s for Buffalo. So you just have a stout team, a team of just on both sides of the ball. They got after it. They instituted this thing called the K-Gun offense, which was basically an up-tempo spread offense, almost like a modern-day Kansas City Chiefs team, you know, with Patrick Mahomes and kind of letting the ball rip, letting the ball go out there. And Jim Kelly, obviously a phenomenal talent, so he could do that, and he can make those throws, and Lofton could stretch the field. So he had just had some phenomenal talent on that team. They make it all the way to the Super Bowl, only to play a Giants team led by this, nobody's heard of him to this day, defensive coordinator named Bill Belichick.
Wonder what happened to that guy.
Yeah, kind of, you know. Her, he went to Cleveland and his career kind of died there in Cleveland, like most people.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, completely did. But like you said, to your point too, on the Bill side of it, like this is one of those seasons, and I think we see it a lot in the NFL sometimes, right? Feels like they were a little early of maybe what people would predict or expect of them. You think this team is getting somewhere, but they kind of surprise everybody by getting all the way to that final game in this year when you think they might be a year or two away.
You see that too with players, right? You see that with guys like Khalil Mack or even Kaepernick.
Oh, right.
Kaepernick, right? Yeah. Yep. So you got guys like Kaepernick who seem ahead of their time in one year, and then the next couple of years, defenses figure it out. They kind of get down to it, and then that's the end, right? And they have that one game where it kind of just falls apart. The teams figure out the antidote to this, and then the career trajectory is over unless there's another remarkable, unless it's a guy who's both mobile and can throw the ball, like a Patrick Mahomes or guys like that.
Sure.
So what happened then and we can go into the details of the Super Bowl because it's heartbreaking and heart-wrenching, but the real storyline behind the infamous two words in Upper New York history is the New York Giants really found the antidote to the K-Gun offense. And that was simply playing some stout defense and time of control. And so they Jim Kelly and James Lofton can't score and they're sitting on the sidelines. And that's what they did. And by the end of the game, I think they had about 19 minutes of total time of possession in this game. Again, they found the antidote for this high-powered offense.
And it wasn't so much, I mean, there's no ending to the praise that's been heaped on Bill Belichick, as you mentioned, the defensive coordinator at the time for the Giants. It's not breaking news. One thing everybody knows about Bill Belichick is his incredible scheming to take away whatever it is you're trying to do. And, like you said, with time of possession, with slowing the game down and just kind of frustrating them, in that matchup there in the 91 Super Bowl.
And oh, by the way, we should reference too that the head coach of the New York Giants, also a Hall of Famer named Bill Parcells.
Right.
So like they got some two Giants. Imagine a team coached by Bill Belichick and Bill Parcells.
Yeah. The two Bills.
That team's gonna get somewhere too. It's no surprising.
Yeah.
Walk me through as you watched this, especially those final moments of this game. What went through your head as a fan, as a a student of football?
I'll tell you the first thing that comes to mind. So the end of this game, if you're not as familiar, you know, we sometimes make the assumption that you listeners are nerds like us and know some of the sports history. But to educate you, if you're not familiar, so this game comes down to a, I believe it was a 47-yard field goal for Scott Norwood. The Bills having been frustrated, as you said, by Belichick's defensive scheme and by the Giants, who it wasn't just scheming, like they had talented players as well, especially on defense.
Wasn't Lawrence Taylor on that Giants team?
Yes, I believe he.
Okay, yeah.
Wasn't like Belichick and Parcells were working with a defense that wasn't good. They were a very good team that year. But anyway, so they kind of have this battle, you know, and slow down the K-gun offense. But it comes down to a setup where they get in position to have the ability to win the game on a Scott Norwood 47-yard field goal. It's a couple things that stand out to me about this. One, Norwood's always gotten killed to this day. Wide right is a famous call. We've had some wide rights in college football as well. But this one just kind of comes back around, I think, especially for Bills. I hate to drag it up because for Bills fans, I'm sure every time your kicker misses something to the right, which happens, you know, you start having that throwback and that feeling of having seen this happen. But one quick note, Scott Norwood was 1 for 5 on 40-yard field goals on grass, on grass field that season. The biggest thing that stands out to me as I watch the final seconds of this game and the unfortunate miss by this kicker that had been very reliable for the Bills is how we take for granted in 2021 the ability to make a 50-yard field goal.
Oh, yeah.
I remember – I'm not even that old, but I'm old enough to remember when something north of 45-yard field goal, you kind of clenched up a bit. And now we routinely expect kickers to make, you know, 50, 52-yard field goals, things like that. Those are kind of the edges of kickers' range. But I think it's sometimes unfair in review to look at Norwood and think that this was a really easy field goal. To me, this is a long field goal for the period. And as I mentioned, unfortunately, he misses it. It goes wide right, and the New York Giants are the champions of the football world. I think for the period, it was a long attempt. It was asking a lot.
Yeah, yeah. And really, you have to give some credit to the New York defense for, again, finding that antidote to the high-powered Bills offense to make it a 20-19 game. Right, or a 20-18 game, whatever, you know, to make it a one possession game and a low scoring game at that against a very, very high powered offense. And, you know, Kelly and Buffalo offense did not help out at all in limiting mistakes and limiting turnovers. But they lost a heartbreaker. So they go back to Buffalo, New York. And what's remarkable to me in this story is how the fans of Buffalo welcomed them as if they were Super Bowl champions, right?
And especially Norwood, right? Like, especially in that parade.
They kind of, you know, they rallied around that. I remember when in the 2014 NFC Championship, when Bostic botched the onside kick for the Packers, the outlash that happened against him and the fan outrage against how could you mess that up, right? Jordy Nelson right behind you, just, you know, let the guy catch the ball, right? So to contrast that against the rallying around Norwood and saying, hey, you know, let's get there next year, we'll be fine.
Kind of a
two sides of a coin there, just showing the difference of the support, probably the difference of eras.
Sure.
From 1990 versus 2014, different time frame, different era. Sure. This is before social media, so who, you know, I'm sure they've been a little different back then if it had social media.
Yeah.
But the key thing is the Giants found the antidote, right? Yeah. They found the recipe to be able to stop the Buffalo Bills and be able to stop the K-gun offense.
Yep.
And then the following year, I think Buffalo goes 13-3. And so, in spite of this in spite of this antidote, in spite of the Giants kind of finding out what to stop this, the Jim Kelly and his crew are still innovative enough and resourceful enough to not let those types of defensive schemes stop them a second time.
Yeah,
they were kind of run the tape. Yeah, go ahead.
They were still very dominant. Like the, it's always interesting to me because people do bring up that idea, especially in the NFL, especially in football, of the blueprint, right? Like the, oh, this team found the blueprint. Well, a huge factor in football and in sports in general is matchups. Like you have to have the right players. So you could, you could look at the tape if you wanted from the Giants Super Bowl, but unless you have Bill Belichick walking through to scheme it up and those players walking through to execute.
Unless you have Lawrence Taylor as your linebacker, I mean, you're going to be limited in what you can do without having a, you know.
Yeah. So, I mean, the Bills showed both in the 90, in the 91 Super Bowl against the Giants. And then even like you mentioned the following year, that this offense was something that was going to be a problem for teams and going to be very, very difficult to stop. You know, the AFC, sometimes people have different opinions as far as, you know, was the AFC the better conference in those years? Was the NFC a little deeper? The NFC seems like it might've been a little deeper, but you had teams like Elway, you know, and and some good, you know, some good teams out there in the AFC as well. And speaking of Elway, you know, in 90, the following year, you know, the Bills are right on track. Like you said, they get through the regular season, that K-gun offense still rolling, and they meet up with Elway and the Broncos in the AFC championship game that following year. And who's the guy that makes the winning game-winning kick or ultimately game-winning kick to send them back to the Super Bowl? It's Scott Norwood. So Norwood winds up, you know, giving them a chance to get back to it. This guy that was the heel the year before from the Super Bowl winds up, you know, sending them on through to back-to-back Super Bowls. And the team they get to face is a team, again, from the NFC East with the Washington, now Washington football team, then Washington Redskins.
Yeah. And a team, again, another Super Bowl team that kind of goes overlooked, I think, in the annals of Super Bowl history, football history, is this 1991 Washington Redskins. You know, that's kind of, you know, people don't realize how good this team was. It's kind of sandwiched between, the sandwich between the decade of the Steelers and Elway, and then, you know, later on the Cowboys dominance. And so they kind of forget just how good this Washington team was back in those days.
Well, because their big stars were the people that don't get the headlines. Their big stars were their offensive line, known as the Hogs. And going into the Super Bowl, that wound up becoming quite the storyline as the Bills, I think he was a defensive line coach, Chuck Dickerson, winds up calling out the Hogs, winds up, you know, making fun of them a bit, you know, for maybe being just dumb brutes. And it's interesting to me going into the Super Bowl against Washington, because the year before, one of the media things that people brought up as far as why the Bills lost to the Giants was they went out and they enjoyed the Super Bowl festivities of that week. And it's one of those things, in hindsight, if you win the Super Bowl, you were loose. If you lose the Super Bowl, you were distracted. So, that was the year before against the Giants, and they wound up losing. And so the narrative becomes, hey, these guys were out enjoying themselves that week and they weren't focused. So going into this Super Bowl, Marv Levy makes a point to say, hey, we're focused, like just in the demeanor. We're not going out. We're not doing these parties. We're not doing these events. We are just focused on winning this game. We want no distractions. And his defensive line coach comes out and gives them all the distractions that they didn't want by calling out the best part of the Washington team and the guy, and just pissing him off, basically. Just pissing off this Hogs offensive line that did not need extra motivation, as they were just for the period. It's always funny, again, to me, to look at like offensive line weight and height now versus even the 90s. Like, it's just guys just keep getting bigger, faster, you know, and it's incredible. But
this was the cream of the crop when it came to offensive lines. And he just starts taking pot shots at him. And kind of creates that distraction that the, that Marv Levy and the Bills, I know Bill Polian and all those guys were really trying to avoid for their team going into this game.
Yeah. Unfortunately for Jim Kelly is that the offensive lineman did not play defense because that might have been a little different for him because he definitely had a rough day that day as well too.
For sure.
You know, it's kind of a rough outing in the Super Bowl with a number of interceptions, some turnovers there. And I think this is where some of the doubt is starting to creep in about, okay, are the Bills really this good? So they end up losing a fairly close game to Washington, all things considered. But again, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a one score game that I can remember. It was a two possession game. But it was pretty, you know, it seemed like the Bills were in it for the most part.
Yeah, Washington jumps up on them early, I think like 14 or 17 to nothing going into the second quarter. And then Kelly and the Bills kind of get it together and mount a comeback to make this a pretty competitive game there in the second half. I mean, this is the, if again, a kind of sports history note. This is the game where Thurman Thomas isn't on the field for the first possession of the Super Bowl because he can't find his helmet. And so, you know, that's something where, you know, again, in hindsight, people might point to, you know, what ifs or if he had, you know, what if he was there to start the game or things like that. But they get in this whole 17-0 and they do come back. And to your point, you know, they wind up losing. I think the final score was 37-24, but it was, it kind of felt contested and a close matchup for them.
Yeah, but it didn't, but they still lost. And it's still, again, for the second year in a row, the fire has been put, water has been put on the fire of the K-Gun offense, right?
Right.
So for the second year in a row, there's this antidote that comes from the NFC East to quench the high powered offense of the AFC East.
Right. Yeah. And now we have back-to-back Super Bowls of a team built on offense where Super Bowl one, they score 19 points. Super Bowl two, they get to 24, but you know, not the offensive efficiency or output that people have come to expect, or frankly, that we see from them through the regular season and the playoffs. And then we get to the Super Bowl. And as you said, these two back-to-back NFC East teams seem to be able to slow down or stymie that that K-Gun offense.
This is also why, if you're sports nerds like us and you grew up in a sports, family that watches sports, these are the games why your dad always says defense wins championships. It's because of these games of watching Jim Kelly come in, watching the high-powered offense, then watching something with, you know, the unstoppable force come against the, unmovable object in Lawrence Taylor and the hogs and offense for Washington, but the stout defense that Washington had as well too.
Yeah.
This is why that phrase, you know, defense wins championships is. Right.
This is the era where that's born. Yeah.
Because of this stuff right here, right?
Yeah, that's where that moniker kind of gets developed and cemented. Like you said, the steel curtain of the 70s, you know, even into the 80s and then now late 80s, early 90s, where it's this philosophy or philosophical differences that we always have and we will always have in professional sports, especially in football. Of the high-powered offense against the stout defense, mm-hmm. and who wins those matchups. I think more and more you see, you know, in more modern history, the offenses having some of those advantages. But the case could be made that with a good defense and a stout plan, you know, you can really limit even the most prolific of offenses.
Yeah.
Like so much has to happen for offenses to be able to click and always be able to click, and the timing and the rhythm and the success and the short throws and the deep throws and the running game, where if you can start breaking that up, especially in a high powered situation or a high intensity situation like the Super Bowl, you wind up, like we see in these first two here for the Bills and their incredible offense, it just winds up deflating you when your offense, for the thing you lean on, isn't able to get going.
Yeah. It makes you vulnerable and then puts doubt in your head. And then all of a sudden, instead of, you know, being, instead of rolling teams like you're used to all season long, you're down 17 to nothing and you have to kind of claw your way back and try to figure out how to get back in this game. And you're still show some resiliency as well too.
Right. Right.
So speaking of resiliency, after this season, I think everyone kind of started writing off the Buffalo Bills as, okay,
yep,
that was cool. That was a nice little run there, but y'all are definitely done. This is, yep, it. There's no more. There's no more. Surprise, surprise, they roll again through the regular NFC season or NFL season next year. And, you know, just, you know, I think again, the 13-3, 12-4, you know, a good solid record.
Yeah,
you know,
dominant. They
kind of dominant once again. And
I think it's the last – which is remarkable of it, not to interrupt you, and remarkable, yeah, to see, because, again, stepping back a little further, we're coming off of years where Elway and the Broncos get to Super Bowls and lose. And then they show just how difficult it is to get back. And here you have the Bills losing once, losing twice, but still on that same type of trajectory going into, you know, the 92-93 season here for this Bills team.
Yeah, yeah. And so they get back, you know, another phenomenal record.
Yep.
And people are kind of surprised again, surprised by how successful this team is until one of the last weeks of the regular season when Jim Kelly goes down.
Yep, knee injury.
And then the knee injury, yep. And then, okay, now people are writing off the Bills because, okay, they lost their, you know, their future Hall of Fame quarterback. This is it. We're done. You know, nice run. And then comes this guy named Reich.
Yeah.
What's Reich's first
Frank,
name?
Frank Reich. Yeah.
Frank. Yep. I was thinking Jim, but I know I was off with that one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In comes Frank Reich, and you know, kind of try to patchwork it. But when you think of a team that's been to the Super Bowl 2 years in a row, losing or its starting quarterback, the reason it's called the K-gun offense, you know, going down or at the very least being hobbled, not 100%, you know, that starts to think, okay, well, that was a nice run the last couple of years. I wonder who's coming out of the AFC this year.
Yeah. Yeah. But again, so Frank Reich, quarterback for the Buffalo Bills now, he starts a wild card round against one of the most talented quarterbacks to ever touch the football in NFL history, a guy by the name of Warren Moon,
yeah,
of the Houston Oilers.
And this is a rematch from the last game. Like, Kelly injures himself in the last game against the Oilers, and now they play them again in the wild card round. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't realize that at all. So the Oilers jump out to a halftime lead of 35-3. Just a phenomenal, you know, they were rolling all cylinders. Reich, yeah, really could not move the ball down the field.
I think it was the infamous, it's actually the now infamous 28-3 at half.
Okay.
Yeah.
28-3 at half.
Yep.
And
then a pick six to start the second. So 35-3. Yeah,
35-3, pick six to start the second. If there's ever a time where you start to think that, okay, maybe these Buffalo Bills are, this is how the story ends of two back-to-back Super Bowls, but getting rolled by the high-powered offense of the Houston Oilers. This is, okay, this yeah, is how this chapter is being written. This is it. This is, yeah, done. And remarkably, I watched the film on this past week, and I still don't understand exactly how this happened. it's like you're watching a Madden game. It really is. Just the precision that Frank Reich had in throwing the ball and just the offense that happened. Yeah, go ahead.
It's like you're watching a Madden game, but and don't lie, people, and say you've never done this. At least maybe in your youth. I'll be honest, well into past my youth. It's like a Madden game where you're playing the computer or you're playing the console and you switch sides. And you start running pump block. so that the other team can, you know, you have two controllers in your hand. That's what this feels like. If you get a chance to go back and watch it, and please go back and watch this game, this wild card game, Warren Moon, and shout out to Warren Moon. Like, what a phenomenal career he's had. Maybe we'll revisit Warren Moon's career sometime on a further review. Just a guy that I think doesn't get enough credit for how good of a quarterback he was. You know, maybe outside of sports nerds and things like that, you know, that recognize in that way. But you have this game, and like you said, 28-3 at half, start off with a pick six, and it's now 35-3. And I also like wound up rewatching this game, and I echo what you say. I don't know how this came back. Andre Reed is running wide open. Don Beebe, no one's covering him. Like, it's remarkable, and credit to Frank Reich. I did a little bit of back research into his college game. He led a comeback against Miami where they were down 31-0, and Frank Reich was at Maryland and wound up leading a comeback. So just the fortitude of not fading away a team that's, I want to take a minute and really point this out. A team that's lost two Super Bowls in a row has had their heart and soul and their guts ripped out twice at the biggest stage, is down 35-3. They lost their starting quarterback.
Yeah.
Like this is the game.
And like, let's put this in perspective too. They lost their starting quarterback. They're down 28-3. And the backup quarterback throws a pick six.
Yeah.
Like, if there's ever a moment where there is your proverbial dagger, that is it.
Yeah.
That's the dagger moment. That's it. It's done.
And the stands,
35-3. That's
it. The stands start looking like COVID stands. Like, the stands start looking like there's nobody there anymore. And like you said, you already think, I imagine, as a Bills fan — I was not a Bills fan in the early 90s, but as a Bills fan, I can't help but think you have written this one off. You think, all right, well, we lost Kelly, the K-gun offense, this is dead. That, well, like, let's see what Wright can do. Okay, this is what he can do. And it's all going bad. And then for whatever reason, and not enough praise can be lauded to this Buffalo Bills team for the fight and the determination to be down 35-3. Not sure what the hell the Oilers were doing on defense, but still to stay in there and to mount this comeback, you know, was incredible, just absolutely incredible. And it comes down to, you know, fans start coming back into the stadium, you know, the whole kind of cliche thing that we see, you know, kind of like the some of the things we've touched on with, like, LeBron James and the Heat versus the Spurs, where all the fans leave and then they start coming back. Fans start coming back as this team starts coming back. And it comes down to a game winning field goal yet again for the Bills, of Steve Christie. To put this thing to bed at 41-38. One of the most — we could have done this entire podcast on that game. One of the most remarkable, like, 28-3 now is the Patriots thing, but 35-3 should be the Bills thing. Like, that is incredible.
They scored — to give you perspective, they scored 28 points in one quarter. in one quarter alone, Frank Reich tossed — I can't remember if maybe Thurman Thomas ran one in or something like that, but they scored four touchdowns in one quarter.
It's just incredible.
Took the Houston Oilers a whole half to do, they did it in one quarter. And then, you know, and then after that, the defense is kind of buckled down. But again, you talk about eras and timelines, right? We look at the score of 41-38 and think, okay, it's, you know, a typical game. But again, this was so ahead of its time for the 1990s.
Yeah.
To see two high-powered offenses go at it, to see this happen and have this is one of the highest-scoring games in the 1990s.
Yeah.
Of 41 to 38, you put up four. You know, most teams aren't putting up four touchdowns in a single game.
Right.
And let alone to do this in, you know, for one team to do this in one half, and then for the other team to follow suit and do the same thing the next half as well too. Just Yeah. A remarkable, remarkable feat.
Yeah, just to your point, the offensive output, incredible for this time frame. I mean, we're talking 79 points put up in this game, and a huge part of that being that resilience and that comeback nature of these Buffalo Bills and Frank Reich in a fill-in role to mount this comeback, which is arguably one of the most historic comebacks in NFL history.
Well, I mean, you look at your Hall of Fame quarterbacks of this era, the era of quarterbacks, right? You have Peyton Manning, Tom Brady, the Aaron Rodgers. You know, I don't put Patrick Mahomes quite in that conversation yet.
You probably get there, but yeah, we'll
probably get there. You know, we'll see what happens. How many of them have scored four times in one quarter?
Right.
I don't think many of them have. You know, these guys are the most prolific. You know, the Drew Brees is these guys who are setting the touchdown records for the NFL, the number of passes, you know, yards passed for the NFL. These guys who are, you know, setting these records, and yet four touchdowns by one guy, you know, 10, 15 years earlier, 20 years earlier now is just absolutely, you know, just incredible.
Absolutely.
Incredible what he was able to do.
And we're talking in comparison to starters. this is the backup, you know.
Yeah, he's doing this in the era of defense, right? He's doing this in the era of the defense, the era of, you know, stout defenses, of limiting the pass and, you know, heavy run offenses.
Yeah.
And Frank Reich pulled this out, and then he leads them on a quite remarkable run back to the AFC Championship game.
Yep.
And then eventually,
and they wind up getting through. I mean, Frank Reich is the catalyst, and I think this game is the catalyst. This wild card game against the Oilers is the catalyst to get them to back to the Super Bowl for the third time. And Kelly is, you know, not 100%, but able to come back, able to start this Super Bowl, and they're going up against Jimmy Johnson, Troy Aikman, Emmitt Smith, and the Dallas Cowboys in what's the 1993 Super Bowl.
Yeah, going against the triplets.
Yeah.
The triplets of that era. And obviously we know what, you know, how dominant this is. But what's lost, I think, in this one is how close the game was at first.
Yeah.
So, and what happens, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's a close game to start off. And then unfortunately for the Bills, Kelly winds up re-injuring that knee in the second quarter. And I think it's a play that's also a turnover that leads to a Dallas score, if my memory serves. But Wright comes back in, and you now have this not so distant history of what he was able to do. And so I think even in that scenario, you have, you know, this close contested game, and Wright comes back in, and you still feel like you have a chance as a Bills fan, as a Bills player, knowing that this backup is not somebody that, or is somebody that we've seen can lead you to victory. But it is close. Yeah. It is close to start for sure.
And you kind of wonder what would have happened because Kelly wasn't great even prior to the injury. He wasn't playing very well. A lot of turnovers. You kind of wonder if that's influenced by his injury, if it was, you know, still hampering him.
Yep.
You kind of wonder what would have happened if Mark Levy had pulled a Doug Peterson and kept his backup in the game through the Super Bowl, and what difference that could have made around that. You know, you have momentum, you have a team. And I get the loyalty to Jim Kelly for everything he's done there, but part of me has to wonder what would have happened if they kind of rode the Frank Reich wave all the way through the Super Bowl. And, you know.
Yeah. And interesting you bring up Doug Peterson, because who's on that staff when they make that decision is Frank Reich.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
exactly.
And having lived through this, you know, maybe thinking, hey, listen, this probably would have been better if we just kept with the guy, kind of kept with the hot hand, but more or less to the game plan around the guy that's been playing, that's been active. You know, this winds up becoming a quite a lopsided affair. You mentioned, you know, the turnovers, Kelly not playing well, Reich has a bad game, Thomas has a bad game. They wind up, I looked up the stats on this game, offensive output, they're actually right there. I think there's an idea that, like, you know, Aikman, Irving, and Smith just kind of run away with this offensively, but they're, the offensive stats are not that different in this game when you compare like totals and such. But the Bills lose the turnover battle 9-2. The reason this is a 52-17 game is the Bills turn it over 9 times. They have 4 interceptions and 5 fumbles. And we all know, like, you factor in, if you turn the ball over 9 times, you're going to get beat bad. And
normally that's what happens. Yeah,
what happens. The one I think interesting thing about this game, and is a credit to the Buffalo Bills organization, the fans, as you mentioned, kind of their output or their outlook when it comes to this team that has now lost a third Super Bowl in a row. The highlight of this Super Bowl is Don Beebe running down a fumble return for a touchdown and knocking it out of, I think it was Lett's hand as he's crossing the end zone. And that play is the play that people remember from the Super Bowl and has been used countless times since, as far as the effort, as far as never giving up. You know, BB's interviewed about this play and he says, "I was just mad. I was just pissed off." Like he was not thinking like, "Oh, it's my duty to run it out. And it's my duty to just do your job" type of mentality. He was just ticked off. And so that was the reason he ran this down. But it's interesting to me that even in a 52-17 loss in the Super Bowl for the third straight time for these Buffalo Bills, that's the play that if you could pick one play from each Super Bowl to represent, you know, what the takeaway or what the, you know, the play that you think of when you think of that Super Bowl, that's the play. And it's incredible. It's the team that turned the ball over 9 times and only put up 17 points and gave up 52. That is actually kind of the remarkable takeaway or play from this blowout loss.
So after losing to the Giants, losing to the Redskins, and now after getting blown out of the water by the Dallas Cowboys, Troy Aikman, Emmitt Smith, and Michael Irvin, Bills are done, right? This is it. This was a remarkable, never done before run of going to 3 Super Bowls in a row. I don't think any team has ever done this before. Some teams have gone back to back, but no team had ever gone back to back before. Just remarkable, remarkable feat. So this is it, right? That's the end of the storybook. That's a fun story. The 1990 Bills, they kind of got their butts whipped by Dallas.
It feels really final, like especially in the lopsided loss. It just feels like, okay, they got there the first time, had a real good chance, got there a second time, was competitive, got there the third time, got blown off the map. It's the final nail in the coffin, you know, for this team.
Especially given all the turnovers that Jim Kelly threw, maybe this is the end of his era. Frank Reich seems to be at, you know, end of his, you know, maybe who's going to know what's coming with Frank Reich. Thurman Thomas fumbling the ball a bunch of times. Again, this is, you know, they self-imploded on the biggest stage once again. And yet the 93 season, right?
93-94
in the season. Out comes the Buffalo Bills, and the mantra of go for 4 is born. And again, Buffalo rallies around this team from upstate New York. And again, they kind of dominate the AFC once again. Again, this isn't like they're sneaking by as a upstart wild card team at 10-6, 9-7, whatever, kind of getting in there and then, you know, running a couple games in the playoffs. No, these are teams that are dominating the AFC. You know, these are teams that are rolling the table, rolling teams throughout the regular season and winning quite handily. Right. These are not, you know, these are teams that are squeaking by. This is the Kansas City Chiefs of today, rolling teams over and over and over again. This is the, you know, watching different, you know, the dominant teams of Peyton Manning and the Indianapolis Colts or you know, the Steve Young and the 49ers of this era as well too, right? Yeah. These are teams that are just absolutely dominating. Buffalo is dominating the AFC East, or the AFC as a whole too.
Yeah, this is sustained greatness. Like there's no other way to really put it. And it's interesting because you watch things or you you know, look up kind of period pieces about this 93-94 season. People outside of Buffalo just want somebody else. And no one can beat them. No one can dethrone them as they once again roll through, for the majority of it, roll through the AFC in this season on their way to the playoffs. And, you know, the go for four, as you mentioned, but also this attitude of people just kind of like this conflict of maybe people wanting to see somebody else or starting to label the Bills as losers. And at the same time, they're beating everybody to get there again.
Yeah. Once again, they're the brunt of every single joke in sports history, in sports books, and even movies and things like that, where people are making fun of them, you know.
Yeah, late night. Yeah.
A movie clip where they got, yeah, late night. Yeah. Everybody's making fun of them. But again, once again, for the fourth year in a row, right? We can't, that can't be emphasized enough. Four times in a row, Tom Brady has never done this before. Four times in a row, they go to the Super Bowl. And once again, they match up with the triplets and, you know, Aikman and Irvin and Emmitt Smith.
They have the Cowboys again. And I feel like just as much as people might be thinking, you know, can we get a different, you know, contestant from the AFC? I'm sure the Bills are thinking, can we get somebody from a different part of the NFC?
Different, like, yeah, exactly.
Where are you at NFC West, you know, like, come on. And, or the Central at that time. Let's play somebody else. But they do. They get matched up against this also dominant team on the NFC side of it, in the Dallas Cowboys yet again, you know, and they're coming back-to-back Super Bowls as the Bills are approaching their fourth.
And unlike the last Super Bowl, this game is actually going in the Bills' favor for the first half of the game, right? They take a halftime lead of 13-6. And are kind of, you know, world shockers at the first half, because everyone expects the Dallas Cowboys, and, you know, for how good Buffalo is, even back in this day, people didn't realize just how dominant Buffalo was on offense, right? They saw Dallas. Dallas was in the larger market, and so they saw Dallas, and were, you know, they understood the high powered offense of the triplets. And again, looking at the previous year's Super Bowl, they kind of expect this to go in Dallas's favor once again of a, you know, high scoring Dallas victory. But now it's a low scoring 13-6 game with Buffalo leading and Buffalo playing remarkably well, limiting the Cowboys' high powered offense to only two field goals in that first half.
Yeah, and we're subject to, even to this day, to look at final scores. And so the final score of 52-17 gives everybody the idea that the matchup between the Cowboys and the Bills wasn't even close. But when you look again at 9 turnovers in that game and the lack of giving them extra possessions and short fields, you know, really makes a difference as far as the actual matchup between these two teams.
Yeah, it really does. And then the Bills go back to giving them turnovers and short fields
in
the second half, unfortunately. And I don't think they score again after that first half. And the Cowboys wind up winning 30-something to 13.
Yep.
I think the final score there. Again, but you look back on this, and unfortunately, that's where the story ends. And then you have a huge drought of no playoff appearances until Tyrod Taylor – and a couple of years back, leads them to their first playoff victory. And now you have them with Tom Brady no longer being in the AFC East. They are kind of looked at as a perennial favorites to win that division with Josh Allen and some of those guys over there now too, with John Brown and some of those, you know, phenomenal players that they have on both sides of the ball. But you have to, so looking back on this 1990s era, the 1990 through 1993 seasons, no other team has ever done what this team has done.
No.
And so when we talk about who the greatest quarterback of all time or who the greatest teams of all times are, you have conversations like with Tom Brady or Joe Montana or, you know, guys like this or Bradshaw versus Brady, right? And you start counting rings. Watching this run this past couple months here of kind of researching this, I'm surprised that Jim Kelly isn't put in that conversation as one of the greatest quarterbacks, and the Bills aren't put in that conversation and as, you know, maybe one of the greatest teams of all times.
Yeah.
Just given what they did, this is just simply absolutely remarkable what they accomplished in this 4-year period.
Yeah. And something that's not duplicated, something that's, you know, the ultimate goal is to win these Super Bowls, but the ability to get to 4 back-to-back-to-back-to-back Super Bowls shows a dominance that needs to be brought to light and needs to be remembered, as we intend to do with, you know, with this look back and this review, to properly give it that type of attention, because as you mentioned, it's something that's not been repeated. And I venture to guess will be a very difficult thing for any team to ever do again. And that's that kind of dominance, that sustained energy. Even looking at, there have only been like a handful, I think 5 or 6 teams that have lost a Super Bowl and even returned the next year. And there's the idea of the Super Bowl hangover. You look at the teams in recent history, the teams that lose a Super Bowl that wind up not even making the playoffs the next year. So the idea that to do that, not once, not twice, not 3 times, but 4 in a row, and the resiliency of this team and this makeup of these players, because the majority of the core players came and went. Norwood was only around for 1 or 2, but the core of this team with Kelly and Thomas and Reed and BB on that K-gun offense, just to come out over and over and over again and put your best work forward, and the success that they had needs to be heralded, needs to be recognized. Mm-hmm. And especially now, when you think about this Bills team and this Bills franchise, this Bills mafia, that is again on the resurgence of a team with a talented quarterback with a cannon of an arm and weapons. I mean, it's fun to me to watch back and look at Andre Reed and Don Beebe and that type of offense and how much they threw the ball, and look at the Bills team of 2020, 2021 and moving forward of the addition of Stephon Diggs and Cole Beasley and John Brown and Gabriel Davis and some of these players coming up for them, for their offense, paired with a guy like Josh Allen. And it just really gives you that hope and that resurgency that, you know, that they might be on the cusp of trying to do something great for themselves as well. But I would imagine every single Bills fan and player looks back on this 90s dynasty for what it was. It was a dynasty in the AFC to go to 4 Super Bowls in a row and to really own the AFC in the way that they did.
Yeah, exactly. And you look at, you know, the dominance of this team, and you compare it with the, you know, the 1990s are dominated by guys like Elway, by guys like, you know, by the NFC. I think the NFC wins 12 or 13 in a row in this time period. And they're dominated by teams like the Dallas Cowboys. We know how good those teams are. By the 49ers with Steve Young and Jerry Rice. We know how good those teams are.
By Brett Favre and
the Packers. We know how good those teams were. And yet, of all these teams that are dominating and taking the, you know, that are dominating this era, this decade, the Bills are the only ones that go 3 times in a row, and are the only ones that actually go 4, you know, to 4 Super Bowls in a row.
Yeah.
Just a phenomenal, phenomenal feat in this time period, and a phenomenal accomplishment for these guys.
Yeah. And an incredible team, because I believe it's easier to ride the wave of success for extended period than it is to ride the wave of success without that final chapter and that final trophy. So to me, the the thing about the 1990s Bills and the Jim Kelly and the K-Gun offense and Mar Levy and Bill Polian and what they built there is the ability to go to four Super Bowls is remarkable of its own feat. I would say the ability to go to those four and never having won one to give you that extra encouragement is quite remarkable on its own as a side factor as well. Like that it's just harder. It's harder to persevere when you don't have the final win.
It's harder.
Think about it in life. Like it's harder to go through and continue to go out and give your best effort and give your most professional, output time and time again, when you constantly seem to fall short. And that's the thing to me about the 1990 Bills that is as remarkable as making four Super Bowls is the fact that they did lose all four of those and just kept fighting and just kept coming back.
Yeah, really is. Like you said, just the resiliency of fighting through disappointment year after year after year. What a remarkable remarkable thing for us to reflect on too, of and just in life, hey, it's not just about chasing that trophy, right? It's not just about doing that. It's about the journey. Hey, thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, go ahead and share it with someone. If you didn't enjoy it, let someone know. Either way, smash that share button.